Yes, the Students for a Democratic Society, and was one of the principal authors of the Port Huron Statement. He was one of the defendants in the Chicago conspiracy trial, one of the most celebrated trials of recent history, and in fact, it was someone who was really at the center of some of the most turbulent and interesting history, probably since the Second World War. He's still involved in politics, although in a slightly different way than when he was a little younger. He is now a Democratic Assemblyman from California, representing the 44th District in their state house. He has a family, as you probably know, is married to the actress Jane Fonda, and they have two children. He has just fairly recently published his autobiography. It's entitled Reunion, a memoir, and it is about the history of the 60s and the 70s and his involvement in it and his own life to the present day. And he is talking with us this morning. And as we talk, of course, you folks who are listening are invited into the conversation. If you'd like to speak with Tom Hayden, you're welcome to do that. All you need to do is pick up your telephone and give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. And the toll-free line, which is good anywhere in Illinois, is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you'd like to be a part of a program, you can call us. Mr. Hayden, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
You know, I have now read a number of articles about you and some interviews with you. And the thing that strikes me is that the authors of the article seem to be doing a lot of head-scratching and displaying some amazement that the former flaming radical has turned out to be such a regular guy. And I wonder whether you think that's something they're picking up from you, or is that something that's in their heads? I mean, are you sort of amazed that you have turned out to be such a regular guy, in your words, a born-again middle American?
I think it's a little of both. I mean, I always was a regular guy, but I have more of the accoutrements now. You know, the house, the dogs, the rabbits, the family. But I think some of it is in the minds of the interviewers as well. I seem to be kind of an inkblot test for people. They see me, but they also react to whatever their feelings about the 60s are, I suppose.
Yeah. Do you really think, you know, when you think about your involvement in politics, does it seem to you that it's all that different now, or in your mind, do you think that maybe what you're doing is not all that different than what you were doing when you were involved in the student movement and SDS and so forth?
It depends on the comparison. I mean, we're a long way from the raging years of the late 60s, where I think the country was really on the brink of civil strife. But if you make the comparison to the earlier part of the 60s, 60 through 64, I feel that, although I'm 25 years older, that I'm full circle back to those years in a sense. I was a student editor at the time in Ann Arbor and was involved in student affairs and in civil rights and in attempts to both participate in movements and reform and revitalize the Democratic Party, and that's pretty much where I am today. I'm the chair of a grassroots organization here in California, Campaign California, that knocks on 600,000 doors a year and works on health issues and consumer issues and environmental issues and insurance and so forth. And I sit in the legislature, and I chair the Committee on Labor and the Subcommittee on Higher Education, so I deal with many of the issues, poverty, job training, student problems that I did 25 years ago. So in that sense, I think there's a direct continuity, and I feel very much the same way.
Mm-hmm. I read an interview where you made the statement that you feel today more like you did at 21 than at any other time in your life, and that's you're talking about?
Right, that's right.
And that is also part of what the title of the book is about.
Reunion has multiple meanings, that's one, but I think that there's a cyclical pattern to life and to history. I don't know if it has to fix on 20 years, but I had a kind of a 20-year odyssey in which I was very much, much of the time at least, estranged from the government and also estranged from my own parents. My father, as I tried to record in the book, wouldn't speak to me for a period of 15 years, during which time he had remarried and had another child who was not told that she had a brother. So it was a very painful odyssey and a lot of separations, but in the end there was a very fortunately a reuniting, and I think that there was a not simply on a family level or coming back together, but that after the late 60s there was some thaw in the mood of America, or at least in California, that allowed a person such as myself to come in from the wilderness and be elected to office.
Mm-hmm. Some of your old comrades clearly think that you have gone over to the other side, and certainly the publishing of the book has given some of them an opportunity to say some of those things. You also say that other people seem to react to you as if the Chicago conspiracy trial had never ended, and there are certainly still a lot of hostility about your visits to Hanoi. There are probably people that remember you for that, if for no other reason. It seems that it would be easy then to fall into a kind of psychological no man's land where you're almost not, you can't please anybody. Have you felt that?
No, I mean, I know that those opinions are out there, but the test for me, or the barometer, is being elected and reelected. When you're running for office and serving in office at the vote of the people, you become clearly aware that at least four of the people walking down the street in front of your eyes have personally voted against you. And that you just don't please everybody. You try to follow your own destiny and your own agenda and communicate where you stand and what you want to do to the voters. And if you get 50 or 60% of the vote, you consider yourself fortunate. I think people in other walks of public life may react more to strong feelings expressed against them, but I don't see that as unusual in the context of always running for office.
Mm-hmm. As you think back to your, you know, your childhood and your time in high school and when you started into college, is there an event or certain events that seem to you now to be the things that propelled you into politics?
It's hard to psychoanalyze yourself, but I was, for some reason, at a very early age, fascinated with books and with reading and with ideas. I was also an only child, and I think that that makes you succumb to the feeling that you're special. But I think it's also the connection with the times. Had I been raised 5 years earlier, 5 years later, I think I would have turned out very differently. As it was, I intersected with history. I became the editor of a student newspaper just at the time that students, particularly in the South, were demonstrating and risking their necks, risking their lives for civil rights. And it was a challenge to me. And I think that at that age, young men and women oftentimes are called to a challenge. They want to test their character. They want to test how they measure up to that kind of ordeal, and I just happened to be there, and was a senior in college and had the power of the student paper that enabled me to travel and to report and see things firsthand. And at the same time, Kennedy was running for president, and I remember my first public speech was in behalf of the Peace Corps, and I remember covering him the night that he came to Ann Arbor and spoke in the middle of the night to about 4,000 or 5,000 students on the steps of the student union in behalf of the Peace Corps. And all of this made me feel at the center of things, and at a moment when it was great to be alive and to have an opportunity to participate and to lead and to write and to speak out. So I don't know whether the times make the man or the man makes the times, but there's certainly some balance there.
It does, you know, when you read the account of the times, yours and others, I guess, at least me, one of the things that I see is that here were a bunch of people, young people, maybe not all of them all that young, but most of them pretty young people, that were so serious and so intense and seemed so sure of where they were going at an age when a lot of people have no idea. And we haven't seen that. I mean, certainly now we have young people who are politically active, but not like it was then. And it makes you wonder what it was at that time. You know,
that's why I think an emphasis has to be placed on the times. I've given a lot of thought to this, and you'd have to be very, very arrogant to say that we were special and unique people. And even if you made that argument, you'd still have to ask why then and why not now and why not in 1955. And I think that not enough attention has been placed in terms of historical scholarship on what it was. I don't know except to say that there was a must have been a period like this before the American Revolution, and maybe during the abolitionist period leading up to the Civil War, when leaders of a new generation came together and felt some kind of common bond or common identity, and literally wanted to change the world, and thought that they were entitled to it and could do it. This happened in the United States throughout the decade, beginning in 1960, but it also seemed to happen in the rest of the world, in Poland, Czechoslovakia, West Germany, France, Mexico. At one point, I thought of calling the book The Class of 68, because I would encounter people who had gone through these experiences even when I was outside the country. People who were activists and the backbone of the Solidarity Union movement in Warsaw, or people in the president's office in Mexico City. I would keep encountering people in Japan who all identified themselves as having been through riots and rebellions in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that anything on a global scale of that kind has happened before. It might have been due in part to television and to the linking together of images and information. But whatever there was a dividing line between bureaucrats on the one side and a younger generation on the other that ran right through this country and many other countries.
Yeah. Well, I have several people who'd like to talk with you. We're talking this morning on Focus 580 with Tom Hayden. And if you would like to call in, our telephone number is 333-9455. Toll free in Illinois, it's 800-222-9455. We'll take our first caller here on line number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I was 10 years old in 1968 and living in the suburbs of Chicago, but all I can remember is watching the convention on television and being told not to get near Chicago because it was, everybody was really afraid. And lately, it's funny that you're on the radio today because I've been wanting to read a book about, I'm sure you'll recommend your book, but do you have other books that you think would tell me more about what went on? It's interesting that I lived up there, but I really didn't.
What suburb did you live in?
Elmhurst. It's in DuPage County.
I have written several chapters on Chicago in my book, and I went back and interviewed the prosecutors in the trial and one of the members of the jury who was from one of those suburbs.
Uh-huh.
Is there Lakewood?
There might be.
The other book, there's a book called Chicago 68 by a fellow named David Farber that's University of Chicago Press that's just out that I think is a good book. And there's a home box office tape of a dramatization of the trial.
Oh, really? Because I am particularly interested when I hear things about being gagged at a trial. Yeah.
I think that the tape is good.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Good luck to you.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll go on here. We have somebody on our toll-free line. We'll take them next. Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
As a member of a family where one of our people was in the North African invasion and really was in battle and had a very rough time there. With that background, I would have to ask you, why did Jane go to North Vietnam?
I'm not sure I heard the first part of the question. Did you say North African invasion?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure how that's
a military family or somebody who served in World War II. Let me say why I went to North Vietnam, and then a word about my wife. I don't really want to speak for her, but I went in 1965 because an opportunity arose, and I thought that it was dangerous to be at war with a country where Americans, including American reporters, were not allowed to travel. President Johnson was claiming that we were only bombing military targets, for example, and that was not the case. I was fascinated with trying to break through the bamboo curtain, if you will, and see for myself what North Vietnam was. I had never been out of this country before, and I probably over-romanticized what I saw, a small peasant nation fighting under American bombardment. But as a result of my trip, which was very controversial at the time, but entirely legal and was upheld in the courts, American reporters were let in and lines of communication were opened with American POWs. And I served as an intermediary in peace diplomacy on several occasions as a result over the next 7 or 8 years. Secondly, on the issue of why Jane went, she was active in the anti-war movement and had been drawn into it by American GIs, frankly, who'd come back and told her that they thought it was a sorry spectacle over there and that she should do something about it as a well-known actress. And there were reports in the spring of 1972, perhaps exaggerated, but reports nonetheless that Nixon was planning to bomb the dams and dikes of North Vietnam, which would break up an intricate structure and flood much of the country, much of the country, and cause a lot of chaos and starvation as a result. And so that was the immediate reason that she went to draw attention to the danger. Which many of us felt that those structures would be bombed and that the whole countryside would be flooded and people would drown. According to the Pentagon Papers, it was considered, but the option was never acted on by President Nixon, thank God. So that was basically it, to try to use her fame and celebrity status as an actress to try to bring attention to what she considered to be a very dangerous an unjustified threat.
Does it surprise you or puzzle you or disappoint you or any other word that so long after that there still seems to be a fair amount of animosity directed both at you and to your wife because you made those visits?
Well, I think it's a little bit strange and exaggerated because many other people did things like this, but it's focused on us because we're in public life, I think, and there are very sincere people like your caller who want to know and find it totally baffling why anybody would do something like that, and I understand her concern. And then there are other people who like to kind of whip up campaigns of scapegoating and vilification and raise money by doing a lot of direct mail against either Jane or myself. And for those reasons, it continues. I tell you, I mean, the Vietnam was a very, very traumatic experience. We lost tens of thousands of Americans for no understandable purpose, and the people who went through that are searching for the meaning of it very, very legitimately. And a lot of other people lost 5 or 10 years of their life by being in the streets or going to Canada, or they stopped speaking to their parents, or they were dislocated. And it's very emotional to lose a portion of your life when you're young, and it's I think to be expected that people continually feel tender emotion about it afterwards. The only comparable catastrophe on a larger level, I suppose, would have been the Civil War, where people were fighting each other, Americans attacking each other, and it took 100 years to begin to get over that. And if you go to the South, it's clear that the feelings still exist. So I expect this to go on for some while.
We're talking this morning on our show with Tom Hayden. He has written an autobiography, Reunion, which has been published here in the past couple of months. It's published by Random House. It's a story of his experiences in the student movement of the 60s and early 70s and of his life to date. We have the lines are full here. We'll get in as many people as we can. If you'd like to talk with our guest, the local number 333-9455, toll free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. We'll go here to line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I go way back with Tom to the days of Ann Arbor, Michigan. And student organization. I was the guy that organized all the foreign students and international students to vote in the early 60s. My name is Moving Shooters.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
And I think I met you maybe two or three times since, early 60 or 59 from Ann Arbor. And I just wanted to know, since I've been terribly involved in the past 10 years with Afghanistan, since originally I'm from there, I wanted to get your views of what is your assessment and your feeling on what happened in Afghanistan to the Soviet armed forces. I hang up and I listen to you, and I would like to talk with you afterward, and I'll call you back.
Okay, well, can you talk about that?
Afghanistan fascinates me, and I'd love to have the opportunity to travel there. I'm not an expert beyond what I've seen in the papers, and I would simply say that it's a sort of Vietnam for the Soviet Union, trying to prop up an unpopular regime against a very strong national movement, and I would hope that under Gorbachev, the withdrawal of the Soviet troops is hastened and is completed. I wish I could give you more of an answer, but I'm no more of an expert than that.
All right, let's go on into another caller, line number one, our next person. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is me.
Yes.
Yes, I just have a comment on You were talking before why in the 60s people were politicized and so forth, and just it's kind of obvious, at least from a personal standpoint, that growing up in the 60s and watching the Vietnam War on television, and then when you're 18 years old, being told or getting a notice that you have to go fight in that war and maybe change your beliefs just because the government wants you to. And when that happens, I think you become very politicized overnight. You have to confront the issue directly. And at this day and age, there's nothing like that to get people directly involved.
I think you're absolutely right, although the draft for Vietnam didn't really take place as a serious life and death matter till 65, so you'd also have to explain the huge developments from the Southern Civil Rights Movement to the Free Speech Movement in Berkeley that occurred before then. And there, I just don't think it was anything so clear and direct as the military draft. It had to be, as I say, some kind of rebellion of the young, I guess, against the world of the old, the segregated world in the South, and the world on the campuses where you were treated as a juvenile.
I wonder.
Otherwise, I think your argument is absolutely right.
I wonder if I could ask you another kind of question. In in the epilogue to your book, you do some taking stock of the legacy of the movement and the kinds of things that were achieved or came about because of the student movement. And at the same time, you also ask why you, and the words you use, why did we who were so able to shake existing institutions leave so little behind? What do you think about the legacy of the movement and what you did or did not leave behind?
Well, I think we created an enormous amount of social change in a very short period of time, but essentially we changed old arrangements rather than developing new ones. We opened up systems that were closed, like the Mississippi political process. Today, Jesse Jackson is the winner of the Mississippi primary. That would not exactly have been possible 25 years ago. Chicago was a closed political system. The Democratic Party, the way that they chose delegates to the convention in 1964-68 was by the president handpicked, and you were, or by the president's men, you were handpicked, and you were loyal to the platform and to the president, and it's, those arrangements don't exist anymore. Your nominees are chosen much more fairly, I think, in primaries across the country by voters and by grassroots people. So all of those things and more happened, I think, as a result of the 60s. But they were process reforms. Out of them became investigative reporting didn't exist until the 1960s. The intervention of Congress in foreign policy. All of these things were process reforms, but in the end, there wasn't a... what I mean in the book is that there wasn't a political party formed or some ongoing institution created out of the rebellions of the 1960s. What happened was in people's consciousness and in the way of doing things. But if you look today at the landscape, the institutions appear to be the same. We have the three networks and the two political parties, and every town has its one newspaper, perhaps two newspapers. Things appear the same. No new institutions were created as a result of the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with some other listeners here, and we'll go next to line number 3. Hello.
Hiya.
Yeah.
I have a question. During a recent broadcast on NPR, Mr. Hayden spoke of his discovery of a natural human need for leadership. That's a pretty close quote, I think. I wonder if he'd elaborate on this notion and disclose its source.
I'm sorry, I don't recall the what the context was. Maybe the caller could elaborate himself. I'm sorry.
Yeah, can you do that?
No, it just that was. I thought it was a curious idea coming from a founder of SDS, and I thought I'd like to find out more about that.
Can you speak to that at all?
I don't remember the context. I mean, it may be that I'm starting to slip here. I've done about 150 interviews in the past 3 months, but I mean, it could refer to anything. I think that perhaps I was speaking of the tendency of people to want myths and heroes, or tendency of people to be starstruck. I don't know if that's it. Maybe the caller can help me, but I frankly don't recall the context of the phrase.
Maybe if the caller can you try and make
but along those lines, it's hard to recall context off of a broadcast.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think here's what he may be getting at, is that in the early and throughout the 60s, there was a vast and legitimate skepticism of towards leadership, and that meant not just the heads of corporations or the Joint Chiefs of Staff or the president or, you know, the really big leaders, but leadership in any sense was seen as oppressive by definition. And so meetings would have, or organizations would have rotating chairs, or people would be... getting the potential of everybody in the organization developed. But looking back, I think it was also a little bit crazy, because it seemed to be based on an envy and a fear of leadership. And perhaps I said in this context that there's a natural human desire for leadership that was being suppressed because we were afraid of it. And I just don't see how in this society or any society, except at sublime moments, you can function without organizational structure and leadership that's explicit and is chosen and is accountable to membership or to voters. If you deny that, then you will not eliminate leadership. You will make it more shadowy, I guess, is what I now believe.
Mm-hmm.
Is that responsive to the question?
I hope so. Let me.
Right.
I'm in my last going into my last 15 minutes here, and I've
all
got
right.
some other people, and I want to get onto them as well. Next, we'll go to our toll-free line, our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. I remember the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 1968. I remember the Chicago police riot. I saw people on Wall Street here in the city selected by police at gunpoint for beating on Wall Street, and I saw them beaten on Burton Place. I saw people going down all around me. I wasn't beaten because I wouldn't run, and I resolved that if any police officer was going to strike me, he was going to strike me walking and as an innocent citizen. I had been on my way to a coffee shop. So I understand where you come from. I have heard it alleged that... various people who went to North Vietnam, who were under indictment by the United States as conspirators, went to Vietnam when they were under indictment and got travel documents Vietnam as agents of the State Department. I know that I couldn't obtain papers to go to North Vietnam, and I'm wondering if you could fill me in on just how these people got over there.
I have no idea who you're speaking of.
Well, I don't remember the names of all these people, and I'm not familiar with your particular case either, but to
go there...
This is the Youth International Party, and their headquarters in Chicago was in a building that was owned or leased by a front for the United States government and so on.
Well, if you're referring to a theory that floated around in the 60s that the Yippies were agents of the CIA or something like that, I never saw any evidence of that.
Well, maybe you could find out about their travel papers.
It'll have to continue to be...
you can find out. You can find out what their travel papers were.
All right, I'll try to do that. But I don't even know if any of them ever went to North Vietnam, so I really don't know where to begin.
Well, I thought you might not know, but I thought you might be interested in finding out. You know, this sort of thing, this kind of allegation circulates as rumor, you know.
Right.
And then, you can find out what papers the government issued them, and then you can put this kind of thing to rest.
Well, I'm sure they issued them a passport if they traveled out of the country. That's the normal thing that that you do to travel. I'll tell you this: I, in part of my book, I've used documents that I got through the Freedom of Information Act from the FBI and from other intelligence agencies. And in one of them, the CIA or some such agent—I guess it was the FBI—is instructing its agents to spread rumors about me to the effect that I might be working for a government agency. And the purpose was to spread a suspicion or paranoia in the peace movement. So I tend to think that rather than pursue how they got their documents, because they probably got them through the State Department, the way you get a passport anyway, that what you have here is a unnecessary and ill-founded rumor of the kind that was often circulated in those days and continues to exist in the minds of some, but I don't think there's any basis for it.
Hmm. I want to go on again to somebody else, but
go ahead.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about. I think your writing is very vivid and it gives you a feeling for what it would have been like. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what it was like then in 68 in the streets and what it felt like and what you were thinking at the time.
I was a very desperate person. I had lost the idealism that I had in the early 60s considerably, and I had lost any sense of patience. I felt abandoned by my parents, by the middle class, by middle America, by the Democratic Party, and the hope of any leadership of the time, Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, both of whom I had known and known reasonably well, were killed, and that made me feel a hatred of the climate in a society that could have led to all this. And Chicago was just sort of a fitting apocalypse that seemed to be appropriate to that very bad year. When the days of the Chicago demonstrations began, I woke up to find a man on my doorstep who had a gun and wouldn't identify himself, and I eluded him and went downtown and found several more, and these were tales assigned to us by the Chicago Police Department, who tried to stay 5 feet behind myself and a few of my friends all through the week, and We were beaten by them a couple of times and jailed and endlessly threatened. And it was a crazy week. On the very first day, a 17-year-old Indian boy from somewhere that had hitchhiked to Chicago was shot and killed. During the week, every night, you choked on gas and tried to escape from what we call daily dozers, these jeeps with barbed wire attached to them that would drive straight at you through the parks. And it's a wonder that more people were not shot, but the beatings that were referred to were systematic and widespread, and a lot of people feel that the police lost their temper. Certainly, they, you know, looking back, they had reason to lose their temper because they were on the front lines of something they didn't understand, and the young people there were provocative in style and language and so on. But I think it's a mistake to think that it was just temper. I think that they were ordered to be systematically and violently in control of the city. They attacked, maced, or beat up at least 20% of the reporters who were assigned to the convention, including Dan Rather on the floor of the convention. The city denied permits to a spectrum of people, from the hippies to the anti-war to the McCarthy people. It was a real breakdown. I think just we didn't understand how determined and fanatical Mayor Daley was in his belief that we were contaminating his city, and it was his city, and the First Amendment didn't extend to long-haired protesters of the war in Vietnam, and it became not a demonstration, but just a week of survival.
Hmm.
It was the Boston Tea Party of its time.
You're now closing in on 50.
50's closing in on me.
Oh, okay. 50's closing in on you. At the time, were there times when you really genuinely felt that you'd never see 50, or maybe you'd never see 40 or 30? Or
I didn't think specifically of what was going to happen to me, if you're speaking of being killed or something of that sort, but I definitely lost any image of a future. I felt that it was day to day, that something was happening all around me that I really didn't understand, that things were out of control, were haywire, that a lot of people were being killed, and that there was no future. I think that's how I would put it. That,
yeah.
There wasn't a future for me.
Well, let's talk to some other people here. We've got about 5-6 minutes left. We'll go next to line number 2. Hello.
Hello, Tom.
Yes.
Hello.
If I detected a hint of weariness when you said you'd given 150 interviews, I want to thank you for giving 151. It's really nice to have you on the phone. I'm a person who's closing in on 40, and I'm sitting in my kitchen, and I actually have my SDS membership card on my kitchen bulletin board,
uh-huh.
And in my front window is a big Dukakis sign,
uh-huh.
And a sign that says, proud to be a Democrat.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know how proud you are of our party.
You're suited up and ready.
Well, yeah, I don't...
40.
I'm ready. I don't advertise on my campaign literature that I'm an SDS card carrier, but it's certainly not a part of my past that I'm any bit ashamed of. Being in California, I wonder if you could give us an update on what's happening with Cesar Chavez and United Farm Workers. We don't get as much news on that front as I imagine you do. And one other thing, I'd love to hear some comments that you might have about the Republican rhetoric from New Orleans, it seems to me that they're just really celebrating their greed and good fortune, and, oh, woe to them if they should have to pay more taxes. All those white people.
You want a short answer?
just tell us something about the farm workers and how you're feeling about the Republican convention.
All right, I talked to Cesar Chavez a couple of weeks ago, it seems an eternity ago, by phone, when he was in the early days of his fast. He now is, I think, at a dangerous point. I forget what day it is, but it's almost a month, and he's trying to fast until this Sunday, where the fast will be ended with a mass in Delano, which is the little town where the farm workers' movement started 25 or 30 years ago. I'm very concerned for his health. He's 61 years old. The conditions for farm workers have improved in one sense, that the public opinion has accepted the idea that there should be a farm workers union and that they should have collective bargaining rights and protection from pesticides and from stooped labor and from the exploitation of child labor. But in reality, while those achievements have been won in public opinion and to some extent in law, a lot of those conditions still remain, and farm workers remain the people that grow the food that's on our table, but they're the least protected in many ways of the entire American workforce. And I chair the Labor Committee in the State Assembly, so I spend a lot of time on this issue. And for instance, we have a $4.25 minimum wage here in California, but it's really not enforced much in agriculture. You've got to go out there to believe that people are being paid half that, and it takes a lot of effort to even get laws like the minimum wage enforced. As far as the Republican convention is concerned, I'm trying to make sense of this selection of the vice president, Dan Quayle. He's a neighbor of yours, I understand, so I'll take your advice, but he doesn't seem to me to add very much to the Bush ticket, and as a Democrat, I'm therefore relieved. I think Bush could have made more successful choices than this one, and I am very actively involved in the Dukakis campaign here in California. We have to win this state, but as a Midwesterner, I'm quite aware that the Midwest is a battleground. Indiana was going to go Republican anyway, so I don't know what Quayle adds. I know that Illinois, Michigan, and Ohio are big battlegrounds, and I don't know if Quayle does much for George Bush there. It seems to me that in the selection of the running mate, Bush may have tried to do an inside job, that is, placate the right wing of his party inside the convention. But as far as what Quayle brings to the ticket outside in the public, I don't know. I thought it was quite insulting that because he's supposed to be handsome, that will solve the gender gap, and that women will flock to the Republican ticket in droves once they see this guy. That makes no sense to me. And the fact that he's 41 years old is really neither here nor there. I mean, it depends on what his experience has been, and his experience has been nil. So the fact that he's young may reinforce the fact that he hasn't been around that much. So I don't understand the positives in it for the vice president. I wish them well. We'll probably watch not the Republican convention, but watch John Tudor in his first pitching appearance for the Los Angeles Dodgers tonight.
Baseball fan, true to and dyed in the wool, huh? Well, we're almost out of time, and I have a couple of other people we can't take, and I'm really sorry. I apologize to them.
I'm sorry I can't be out there. I've been in Champaign-Urbana many times, and I wish you well. Thanks for.
So I just wonder if I could just I wonder if I could just ask, you know, one thing and get a quick response. I read in your book, you're talking about how affected you were at the assassination of John Kennedy and how you felt that it meant that there was a real force of evil that was stalking the land and maybe also stalking you, and about how moved you were seeing that image, as so many people were, of his little son saluting. And I wonder, you were at the convention in Atlanta. I wonder what your thoughts were when you saw that little boy, who's not a little boy anymore, up there on the podium.
Well, you know, as fate would have it, the moment that Michael Dukakis was nominated and the crowd was cheering and Coming to America was playing and Dukakis was making his way to the podium and giving his speech, I was standing with John Kennedy Jr.
And?
I don't know what to say. I mean, it just he's a friend of mine, and Courtney Kennedy, a daughter of Bobby Kennedy, was also with us, and I think that. I grope for words because I don't. It's hard to know what the meaning of it all is. You know, is the Kennedy youngsters are now full grown and many of them very committed, all of them very committed to public service and doing many of them doing very important things, the legacy of their fathers goes on, but I certainly feel that the killings of John and Robert Kennedy were and Martin Luther King were the events that gave the Times their tragic character and robbed us of our best possibilities for leadership and created a melancholy about the 60s that always has to be there. Mm-hmm. Alongside the sense of achievement. But I guess I've come to believe that it's best not to think in terms of how much of our hopes died with them. The better way to look at it is to ask how much of their spirit lives with us. And that's the proper way and a more invigorating way. And all I can say is that there was a positive energy there on the floor of that convention in Atlanta, and a historic energy and a sense of rebirth.
Okay, that's a good place for us to stop. I've enjoyed talking to you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Our guest this morning, Tom Hayden, and if you're interested in reading more of his story, you can look for his book. It's entitled Reunion, a memoir. It's published by Random House. Well.